Thank you, Jim. As you can see, I'm a little shocked. I think when Jim first told me that the group has asked if I would do a Way Seeking Mind talk, a part of me wanted to run away and say no, not me. But another part was shocked, because I still consider myself new and dipping my toes into the Dharma. And I told my wife that I would tell everyone what she said, because I told her, I said, oh, they asked if I should do a Way Seeking Mind talk, but I've just dipped my toes into the Dharma. And she told me, she says, oh, but you've been going to the book study and you've gone to the day retreats. If that's dipping your toes in, I don't know what you think you're doing. So, I'm thankful that she encouraged me to do this talk. And yeah, when I first thought about this talk, it's interesting to think about how did you end up in the spiritual practice that you were in, even when you weren't raised that way. And so to think about your story about where you began and why you are here, led me down an interesting path of introspection. I thought months about what I was going to talk about, what part of me that I was going to divulge or not divulge, how much of my family history to tell. But I guess with all things, there's always a beginning. And I think personally, I've come to a point in my life where, I'm very grateful for my family history and my parents, because I feel that, I would say, karma, trauma, ups and downs in my life, all my successes, I believe came through them and their karma and their trauma. So, I would like to start with a little family history that I believe would tell my story. So I'm originally from Jersey City, New Jersey. I was born there and then later moved to Newark, New Jersey. I believe Larry's family is from the East Coast. So he might know certain parts of my story or feel some of the descriptions of New Jersey. But my parents, Richard Hicks and Valerie Hicks, they were both born in New Jersey, Jersey City to be exact. Their family from various areas in the East Coast. My dad's family, his grandparents are from Virginia. My mom's parents and her grandparents are from South Carolina. And with a little bit of history of that, it's interesting being African American, and when you think about family history, certain parts of your history is kind of lost to time. No records are really there. And recently, I've been able to gather bits and pieces of my history from my mom and dad. I believe as they have gotten older, they've shared more stories with me. So mostly with Christine, my wife, she's very into, or she questions them a lot when they tell her stories. And through her, I've gotten more history from my family. My mom's family, they're from South Carolina, around the Charleston area, Jones Island, Hollywood. And their history, at least I know a little bit of my grandma's history. Her parents, my great grandparents, were born in Jones Island in South Carolina. And before then, we really don't know much, but I've done 23andMe, and it looks like their parents might have been from Nigeria, which is interesting. So you're thinking late 1800s, probably. So that's interesting to find out. But my mom's family, just to go a little bit with my spiritual background and how I was raised. Her family, my grandmother and my grandfather were both raised Baptist. And so with that, as with Southern African American culture, going to church was very important to them. Some of my earliest memories weren't really going to church, but actually appearing at funerals throughout different family members. And one of my earliest of seeing a Baptist church was from my grandmother's funeral, which was around 4 or 5. And I remember that kind of vividly, but I sort of remember that as my sort of going to church in South Carolina and seeing a Baptist church. So that, you know, that has always stuck with me as like a powerful image. My dad's family, his mother and his father, were both raised Jehovah's Witness, and they were from Jersey City, my dad's mother. And my dad, actually, his father sort of disappeared for a bit, and I'll sort of go back to that story because I believe my grandfather's story sort of weaves into my story and how I handle life. But my dad's mother had a heart condition. I don't know which heart condition, but she was, I would say, most of the time sick in bed. And so she couldn't take my dad to the temple to study about, you know, Jehovah. So he was basically taken to church by his extended family, his cousins, and they took him to a Baptist church. So around about 15 to 16, my dad converted from Jehovah's Witness to Baptist. And that's the religion that he basically practiced now. My mom, on the other hand, later converted from Baptist to Roman Catholicism. And so growing up, my dad stayed Baptist and my mom stayed Roman Catholic. And it's interesting, they're still together now. And so my household basically was two denominations of Christianity. I don't know when they decided that I was going to be raised Roman Catholic, but I believe my dad left that up to my mother. And so I was baptized Roman Catholic. And for, I would say, from grammar school up into high school, I was a practicing Catholic. I went to my dad's church, I would say, only on Easter. That was the time where I went to church with my dad. And anyone who was raised Baptist knows that Easter service is extra long. It is a 3-hour affair. And I remember I loved dressing up to go to Easter Sunday at my dad's Baptist church. He would, him and my mom would save money and get me a brand new suit just to wear for Easter. It was very interesting. And, you know, if anyone has been to a Roman Catholic mass and then you go to a Baptist service, it's almost night and day. Whereas Catholicism, I believe it's, you know, it's similar to Soto Zen, not in beliefs, but, you know, there are chants and then there's an, I would say, a ritual and an order to the way mass is run. And there's very little deviation, whereas Baptist church is very lively, I would say unscripted a lot of the times. And so for me, who was a very quiet and introspective young person, going from Catholic mass to my dad's Baptist church was very unnerving. I didn't know what to do. I didn't clap. I didn't stand at the right times. And I was mostly prompted by people to get up and dance and sing and clap. And me, I was like, no, that's, you know, I'll stand, I'll bow, and then I'll sit back down. And so that was kind of awkward. But through the years, I learned to navigate between the different churches. So, yes, growing up, my parents, you know, I have a very, I would say, strong foundation in Christianity. And, you know, most of that has never left me. It still stays with me. My parents are very practical people, whereas you know, they would, we were, you know, they were very dead, or they are very dedicated Christians, but in certain instances, you know, the morality and ethics of living in an urban area sometimes trumped what was appropriate action. And one of my earliest things that my dad said to me, and it's interesting, it sticks with me till now. You know, I was a little kid, and I don't know what happened. Maybe I told him someone hit me, and, you know, and being raised by my parents, I knew hitting people was wrong. It was very wrong. And I think I might have told my dad, oh, you know, somebody hit me, and then I hit them back, and I felt really bad about it. And my dad, you know, he sort of looked at me and was like, yes, you are not supposed to hit people. In his exact words, you're not supposed to lay hands on people. That is not what you do. But he told me, but if you need to protect yourself, protect yourself. And he's a very practical and logical person. And his teaching was, someone hits you, you nicely tell them, that's not how you like to be handled. You do not like to be hit, and they should not hit you. And his reasoning was, you tell that to them as many times as possible. And then when you think it is not safe for you to do that, then you can go tell an adult. And if they do not help you, you can maybe hit them just as a deterrent to make them to stop hitting you. So it was very interesting and logical. And I remember sitting there looking at him like, yes, yes, that makes sense. Do not hit people unless threatened. Okay, yes. my mom, since, you know, most of the time I went to church with her, I was basically raised most of the time in the Catholic Church. I went to a Catholic grammar school from kindergarten to eighth grade. There, you know, we had religion class every day. And my mom, I believe, got at this point in her time, maybe she was in her 30s, she was very involved in the Catholic Church. So much so, for people who know, she was a Eucharistic minister. So during the ceremony of sharing the body and the blood, she was the one who prepared the body and the blood and gave it out to the parishioners. And she was also a Sunday school teacher who prepared kids for communion, confirmation. And I mostly sat in those classes with her because my dad was off at Baptist church. And so I got my religious education through multiple Sunday school teachings from probably, I guess, church started at 9 and we probably stayed until like 2 because my mom taught multiple Sunday school classes. So most of the time when I was in school, I knew a lot of the history of Roman Catholicism before most of my classmates, just because I was kind of dragged along with my mom to teach these classes. But, you know, I love stories and I love history, and I love religious history and the historical background of how religions come to be. And I just remember as a kid really enjoying those classes and sometimes answering questions and I guess getting made fun of because I wasn't in the class and I was answering questions. But I really love the history of Roman Catholicism. And so, yeah, so throughout grammar school and then high school, I actually chose to go to a all boys Catholic school, which was actually run by Benedictine monks. And there they went into the history of Catholicism almost to like such detail that, you know, in some cases I felt some people got really upset because it felt like it took some of the, I guess, the mystery away from Christianity, because there, you know, we learn how the prayers came about, what was the history. I remember doing reports on the Gospels and how they were different from each other and why that was different. And so I believe around that time that there was a little bit of skepticism growing as I started learning the history and the Benedictine monks, they were, I don't know much about orders, but they seem to be very much engaged in the scholastics of theology. And so they taught the good and bad of Christianity. And they let you decide where you stood. And so I thought that was very interesting. And I really liked that they didn't try to hide or give answers that were not there. They basically told you the history and basically said, this is your faith. With this knowledge, you choose whether to follow or not. And I thought that was very nice, and I really appreciated going to that high school. Even though, I believe as I got educated, I started asking, well, not questions, just little things in my mind bothered me. Like there was how they felt about the LGBTQIA community or queer community or gay community. I got real mixed feelings about that, where I felt there wasn't compassion and love and understanding, and amongst other things. And so, there were, I don't remember exact sermons, but I just remember there were sermons about the gay community, which, I left the church feeling like, oh, that doesn't sound like love at all. And not to say that that is Christianity. That was just what I saw in the sermons that I went to. And I've met a lot of friends who are now Christians now, and that isn't the case for all churches and most of Christianity, but that was my experience. And so I don't remember whether I brought that up to my parents, but when I think now for how much Christianity means to them, I'm very shocked on the things they allowed me to, books they allowed me to buy, and things they allowed me to educate myself. Because I was very much into esoteric things. I was very much into, oh, I heard about demons or witches. Oh, let me go buy a book about that. It was like, oh, in high school, I heard about these lost books that they decided to take out the New Testament and Old Testament. So I would ask my parents, give me money. I want to buy some of these apocryphal books that were taken out of the Bible. And they sort of looked at me and was like, all right, as long as it's books, go ahead and buy them. And they didn't ask many questions. And so, they had one stipulation. It was, don't worship the devil and don't practice witchcraft, which I thought was interesting because in my mind, I said, oh, witchcraft is real? Okay. But so, that was interesting. That made me want to learn about that even more, because then I now you piqued my interest. So yeah, and so I'm a fast forward to college. So in college, I was always interested in history and just learning new things. So I decided first to major as a computer science major. So I'm a programmer now, so that's what I went to school for. But while I was there, I really got into philosophy. So much so, I took so many classes. I then ended up dual majoring because I took so many philosophy classes. I was just like, oh, I might as well just throw that on there. But in one summer, as I was trying to figure out what to take for my next philosophy class, I saw Asian philosophies. And being the person who loves to read about things that he's never heard about, I decided to sign up for that class, not knowing what Asian philosophies was going to be about, because through my studies in Catholic school from eighth grade up until senior year in high school, I mostly heard about Western philosophers. I heard about, say, Thomas Aquinas and, Aristotle, and early in college, during my phase, I would say my very skeptic phase, I fell in love with Descartes and Nietzsche, and that didn't go over well because, I read, Nietzsche told me God was dead. And so I didn't fall into a phase of atheism, but I started considering myself being agnostic, not really questioning whether God exists or thinking that I needed to answer that question. It just at that point in my life, it didn't seem that important to me. I really wanted to get into philosophy because I felt there was something for my personality that was missing in my practice in Roman Catholicism. So I delved deeply into philosophy, into ethics and morality, and then I found this Asian philosophy class. And so I remember, my mom, I think she got the transcript, or maybe I told her, because I don't know how that came about, but I told her I was taking an Asian philosophy class, and she asked me, "Oh, what is this?" And I said, "Oh, we're gonna learn about Taoism and Hinduism and Jainism and Buddhism." And I remember her reaction was, "Oh, well, you're not supposed to be learning about that stuff because you're a Christian." And so I was kind of thrown off by that, and I was like, "Okay, but I'm a philosophy major, so I have to learn about all the philosophies." And so she said, "Okay," and she sort of left it at that. And so, yeah, in Asian philosophies, I believe I really fell in love with Taoism first, and then later Buddhism. And I felt like when I heard about Buddhism and the first truth, which is suffering, there was a part of me that really grabbed onto that, because I'm not sure. I believe in Catholicism, or at least when I was learning it, we know that there is suffering. We know that potentially that Jesus suffered, and then it is relief from suffering, if not in this life, in the next. And so my thinking was, I don't want to wait for the next life. I kind of want to deal with my suffering now. I feel like this life can be just a little bit better. And then I just read about Buddhism, and being the computer science major and the philosophy major, and seeing that there's an eightfold path to ending suffering. For me, it was like, oh, you just gave me some steps. Something that I can do to help with my suffering right now. And that just spoke to me, especially as a programmer who deals with steps and iterations. I need direction. I need something that I can work on, or at least wrap my mind around, that can give me something to work with now, because I feel that I'm a very practical person. And so even in practice and in spirituality, I feel like I need something now that I can work with. And to go back a little on why I thought that, when I was in high school, I'm not sure what brought about this, but I went through a major phase of depression. And I think there was various things which led me to depression. There was a feeling of not belonging. I later learned in my 30s, like, this, it wasn't just depression, it was a form of anxiety. I learned this later through Bhakti Yoga, but I think in Buddhism they say too, I have a very active monkey mind. And my mind and rumination, in my high school years, led to me ruminating about all the mistakes I made in the past. So not being in the present. And so I really felt Buddhism and Zen in particular, with its view on ending suffering and its view on being in the present, I felt that, oh yeah, I knew in my depressive stage that I was so focused on the past that most of the time I couldn't really focus on the present. And so focusing on the present and being aware of what's going on, you know, to me made sense because it can get me out of that past rumination. And so my depressive phase ended before I actually went to college. And I'm not really sure how I got over it, but it is similar to being in the present, which I felt was true when I learned about Buddhism, is that I just stopped thinking about all the things I did wrong in the past. You know, I sort of forced myself to be like, that's not helping me to focus on that. And so I slowly overcame that phase. And with that, there was something in Buddhism that felt true. And one of the things that I stuck on with Buddhism for a long time, and this is even until my 30s, till where I started to focus on reading books and Zen and Buddhism, was interdependent arising. And for me, I felt like that sort of meshed with how I thought about things. Like earlier, I talked about my family history and how I'm grateful for them. Karma and trauma, because in my thinking around that time, I am who I am because of them. You know, I am who I am because of the people around me, who I interact with. And so the very thought of my actions affecting other people and being weaved into this story of humanity and the people that we touched just sort of made sense. And I have an excerpt. I actually wrote a paper on interdependent arising, and it's half from a book called Asian Philosophies, which was the class, which was actually given by John Kohler, which I believe he wrote the book, I believe, with his wife. And so they wrote an Asian philosophy book and a source book, a textbook that they taught at the SUNY schools. And so in this paper, one of the things that I picked out that I really liked was this. Rather, human life is a continuous process of change, rising and falling through interdependence with numerous other processes. This insight into existence as a continuous process of change as a result of interaction with other processes became one of the most important teachings of Buddhism. Known as interdependent arising, this was the key insight of Buddha's enlightenment, providing him with a basis for understanding what suffering is, how it arises, and how it can be eliminated. This enlightenment has shown the Buddha that ignorance of this truth was the root of all suffering. Understanding interdependent arising is crucial in the cessation of dukkha or suffering. Now, what the Buddha realized is that nothing exists by itself. In short, the Buddha was saying that suffering is the inability to live well when at odds with the truth of interdependent arising. Oh, I don't know. I look back at how I read that, and I basically think that I barely had any idea what I was writing down or had a very shallow understanding of it. I think I still have a very shallow understanding of it, but I believe that sort of connection to that sort of made me realize that the connectedness of, or connectedness of things, and how everything is relying on everything. There is nothing in this world that does not exist because of something else. And there is nothing that isn't touched by our presence. And so with that, you know, I feel like I have in studying that Buddhism, I have a appreciation for my grandparents, my great grandparents, my dad, my mother, and, you know, all the hardships that they went through. Maybe they weren't good hardships. Some were, you know, some were good, but they ultimately helped me get to where I'm at. And so, yeah. And so I really like that about Buddhism. And so I'll fast forward again to in my 30s, around the time where I visited Valley Streams. That was during my, I coined that as my 30-year-old midlife crisis. And yeah, it's interesting because I do remember talking to my dad, and this was a rough time because, you know, I believe, you know, everyone gets to a point, you know, 30 isn't by far old, it's not young, but you know, we all reach this point in life where family members start to pass away. And for me, it had it happen earlier when I was younger, but in my 30s, it started happening a lot more. And sort of my anxiety sort of came back there. And anxiety, fear, all of the above, you name it. And I remember asking my or talking to my dad. I said, "Oh, I'm having a hard time, you know. You know, I just turned 30. I don't know what to do." And my dad responded, "How do you think I feel? I just turned 60." And sort of made me laugh. And I said, "Oh, that's a good point. You know, you're putting everything into perspective." And you know, we started talking about people passing away, and around the same time, my dad's mother passed away. And you know, he basically said, "You know, this is life. You know, you have to take those moments with the people you have, and you have to remember them." But he was like, "You know, you still need to figure out how to live." And so, you know, it was interesting, you know, when he said that around that time, you know, I was having my 30-year-old crisis. You know, I sort of remember when my grandmother passed, and it was interesting. His mother, she had, I believe, pancreatic cancer. And so she was supposed to get surgery, but because she's Jehovah's Witness, she chose not to have the surgery because I believe it required a blood transfusion. And so for her, I'm not sure the details of the religion, but I think on her card it has, you know, will not take a blood transfusion because I think they can't take transplants or blood transfusion. So she just decided not to go with the surgery because of the blood transfusion. And I remember going to see her and my dad being there, and you know, I just remember the strength she had. Yeah, and she was strong in her faith all the way through, and just, you know, that sort of example was just like, oh, you know, to me that was an example of someone who was really, I wouldn't say sure, but really strong in her faith, in her spirituality. And that really stuck with me. And so when my dad talked about that, I was like, okay, you know, I can deal with this, you know. And so around that time, I went and I first went to a yoga studio because I was practicing yoga at that time. And I heard they were doing a bhakti yoga meditation. So I tried that for a bit. It didn't, you know, after reading about Buddhism and Taoism, I was like, oh, okay, let me see if there's some Taoist teachers or some Buddhist teachers around. And so there wasn't any Taoist teachers, although I loved reading about Taoism, but I did go online and I saw Valley Streams. And so I remember it was around 2011. I remember the faces that I remember were Clem and Jim. And I remember, I don't know if Clem you were giving out. I feel like I got Zen mind, beginner's mind there, because I think Valley Streams at one point had Zen mind, beginner's mind there. And so I remember buying some books there. I'm not sure if that's true or not, or if I'm remembering that correctly. But I remember, I believe it was Jim who taught me first how to do Zazen. And I remember saying, like, oh, this is nice. This is kind of like the meditation that I've been doing on and off. And And so I stayed for the service afterwards and then did some more zazen. And there was something about it that I really liked. And I believe I came a few times. Don't even remember why I stopped. A stop come going, but at that point I lived in Roseville, so for me it was a drive at one point, but I really don't know why I stopped. But around that time of going and not going, I then started to feel more anxiety. Didn't know technically how to manage it. And I used a lot of things. Most people in the book study know that I'm going back to school to study to be a registered dietitian. And that was because around this time, to deal with my anxieties, I thought, oh, what goes better with, the fear and anxiety of living and death than to focus on my own health and wellness? And so, with that and some health issues, mostly brought on by anxiety, I thought, oh, I'm gonna go into nutrition and study that up. And so while trying to, I guess, diagnose myself, manage my own anxiety, I used exercise, my own meditative practice, reading more about Zen as a way to manage my own anxiety. And then in 2014, my godmother passed away. She had sickle cell, so it was very sudden. And so that sort of threw me for a loop. And so around that time, I had a, I believe, a panic attack, which I think was a mental break of sorts. And I just remember being completely lost. Not lost in a sense, but kind of in, I learned later because I then contacted a friend who now is studying Buddhism too, I believe, Tibetan Buddhism. And I told him how I was feeling, and he basically said, or I asked him, I said, I think my methods of handling this isn't working anymore. And so he told me, I should seek out someone who practices cognitive behavioral therapy. And so around that time was sort of rough. I believe, it was at a point where I know there are some people in the Sangha who are therapists. And so I later learned that I was having a dissociative episode. So, I found that it was very hard to connect to people and not, it was a combination of not being present, being so deep into anxiety that I couldn't rightly connect to people around me. And that was rough. Being around family members, my wife, other people at work, and just feeling very untethered. And so I think around that time, I really gravitated to Zen mind, beginner's mind. I really gravitated to the stories in Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, and I believe that was at a time where, in book study, we've gone over a number of books. And I know in one of our chants, we talk about seeking refuge. And, I think around that time, Zen and some of the stories, Dharma became my refuge. It became how I sort of organized my mind, And I remember I was talking to my therapist, and at one point, I was telling her, I was like, oh, I was heading to work and I was having a real disassociative moment. And I was telling her, I was like, oh, I was reading this Zen book and it was saying focus on the present. And so I told her, I said, I went into like a meditative state and I just focused on driving. I didn't think about how I was feeling. I didn't think about, you know, the anxieties I was going to have at work. I just sort of focused on what I was doing at the time. And I just remembered that I had a day where that's all I kept doing. It was, I'm driving, I'm focusing on driving. I'm at work, I'm focusing at work. I'm talking to people, even if I'm not feeling connected to them, I'm listening, I'm asking questions. And I believe that with, you know, my therapist is kind of what got me out of that. And so, yeah, and it's, there's just, you know, so many stories. And I believe one of the things, you know, I used to say as a mantra, the Eightfold Path, not the whole thing, but the two that really stuck with me with being, with disassociating from reality, having anxiety, and just thinking, or being stuck in thinking about the present, thinking about the future. I would say to myself whenever I got caught in this cycle of just stuck and ruminating, I would think to myself, is this right thinking? Am I seeing things clearly? When I would think, oh, you know, I don't think I'm gonna get out of this. I can't function today. You know, I would tell myself, is that right view? Can you really not function? Are you doing right thinking right now? And so yeah, I would say that to myself. It's like, no, I'm doing fine. The day is only bad. I'm only feeling anxiety, or I'm feeling anxious around people because I'm anxious around being with people. That I'm scared of the next episode. And so there are parts of the Eightfold Path that I thought was keeping my mind in the present, sort of. And so I really appreciated that. So I think, what was it? I wanted to read a story about, I feel there was a story that I often read when I felt that my perceived worries, because I feel like, you know, when you're feeling generalized anxiety, you get into a state where you're not in mortal danger, but it's almost like you can't focus. You know, sometimes I couldn't read, I couldn't do work. And so I felt like, you know, you feel, I can only say it's an extreme sense of loss of ego. And, you know, I love in Zen when we're trying to overcome the ego. And I think it's awesome because at one point I was so afraid of losing myself that it was painful. And so, you know, and I would read these stories and I would say, oh, I need to be like the Zen masters in this story. I need to be calm. I need to see things clearly. And so one of the stories, which I love, and I believe it's like the 18th story of Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. It's number 18 and it's called A Parable. And this is how it goes. Buddha told a parable in a sutra. A man traveling across a field encountered a tiger. He fled, the tiger after him. Coming to a precipice, he caught hold of the root of a wild vine and swung himself down over the edge. The tiger sniffed at him from above. Trembling, the man looked down to where, far below, another tiger was waiting to eat him. Only the vine sustained him. Two mice, one white and one black, little by little started to gnaw away the vine. The man saw a luscious strawberry near him. Grasping the vine with one hand, he plucked the strawberry with the other. How sweet it tasted. I always loved that story because, you know, he was in mortal danger, yet he was still living. At that moment, he didn't think about the tigers or the mice gnawing at the vine. He was so in the present, he said, oh, there's a strawberry. And at that moment, that strawberry was the best strawberry because it's the only strawberry. I think that's like a koan. For me, I'm not sure if I'm getting it right. I probably read it 3 times and each time I get something different. But I always go back to that. And so I'm gonna end on the last, I guess, time that really told me that, you know, I needed to go visit a sangha and practice. And so this was in 2018. My wife was pregnant, and we found out that our baby had a very serious encephalocele. And so it's a spinal disorder where the skull does not fully close. And we named her Tanaz. And so she had a frontal encephalocele, which means that her brain was coming out through the front. And so we went through a number of tests and we got second opinions, but basically we learned that she would pass away at birth. And so, you know, me and my wife, we decided that we, you know, normally it is, yeah, two things people decide, that they're gonna induce labor, or three, they're gonna induce labor, they're gonna have full, they're gonna do the full term and then witness it, but witness the death. Or they do, and I'm sorry if this is triggering to anybody, you know, they do, I believe, what they call a DNC. And so me and my wife decided we're going to do induced labor because we want to see her. And so we did do that. She passed away. And so, you know, that was, I believe that was a time where I was coming towards the end of my anxiety. I was still having dissociative moments, but I believe I was fully present for that. And so when she passed away, I remembered a story from actually Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And when she was born, I actually read that to her. She only lived, I believe, maybe a minute. I don't know, maybe a few seconds, but at her birth and death, I read, and I'm going to read this, Nirvana is the waterfall. And it's from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Suzuki. And I'm going to read that because, you know, we're running out of time, but I feel like, you know, this, you know, I always come to this because, you know, for me, this sort of sums up, you know, not life, but the mystery of life and the mystery of death. And so Nirvana, the waterfall, our life and death are the same thing. When we realize this fact, we have no fear of death anymore, no actual difficulty in our life. That was the beginning. If you go to Japan and visit, and I'm sorry for the pronunciation, Ihaji Monastery, just before you enter, you will see a small bridge called Hansaku Kyo, which means half dipper bridge. Whenever Dogen Zenji dipped water from the river, he used only half a dipperful, returning the rest to the river again without throwing it away. That is why we call the bridge Hansaku Kyo, half dipper bridge. At Ihaji, when we wash our face, we fill the basin to just 70% of its capacity. And after we wash, we empty the water towards rather than away from our body. This expresses respect for the water. This kind of practice is not based on any idea of being economical. It may be difficult to understand why Dogen returned half of the water he dipped to the river. This kind of practice is beyond our thinking. When we feel the beauty of the river, when we are one with the water, we intuitively do it in Dogen's way. It is our true nature to do so. But if your true nature is covered by ideas of economy or efficiency, Dogen's way makes no sense. I went to Yosemite National Park and I saw some huge waterfalls. The highest one there is 1,340 feet high. And from it, the water comes down like a curtain thrown from the top of the mountain. It does not seem to come down swiftly as you might expect. It seems to come down very slowly because of the distance. And the water does not come down as one stream, but is separated into many tiny streams. From a distance, it looks like a curtain. And I thought it must be a very difficult experience for each drop of water to come down from the top of such a high mountain. It takes time, you know, a long time for the water finally to reach the bottom of the waterfall. And it seems to me that our human life may be like this. We have many difficult experiences in our life, but at the same time, I thought the water was not originally separated, but was one whole river. Only when it is separated does it have some difficulty in falling. It is as if the water does not have any feeling when it is one whole river. Only when separated into many drops can it begin to have or express some feeling. When we see one whole river, we do not feel the living activity of the water. But when we dip a part of the water into a dipper, we experience some feeling of the water. And we also feel the value of the person who uses the water. Feeling ourselves and the water in this way, we cannot use it in just a material way. It is a living thing. Before we are born, we had no feeling. We were only with the universe. This is called mind only, or essence of mind, or big mind. After we are separated by birth from this oneness, as the water falling from the waterfall is separated by the wind and rocks, then we have feeling. You have difficulty because you have feeling. You attach the feeling you have without knowing just how this kind of feeling is created. When you do not realize that you are one with the river or one with the universe, you have fear. Whether it is separated into drops or not, water is water. Our life and death are the same thing. When we realize this fact, we have no fear of death anymore, and we have no actual difficulty in our life. When the water returns to its original oneness with the river, it no longer has any individual feeling to it. It resumes its own nature and finds composure. How very glad the water must be to come back to the original river. If this is so, what feeling will we have when we die? I think we are like the water in the dipper. We will have composure then, perfect composure. It may be too perfect for us just now because we are so much attached to our own feeling, to our individual existence. For us just now, we have some fear of death. But after we resume our true original nature, there is nirvana. That is why we say to attain nirvana is to pass away. To pass away is not a very adequate expression. Perhaps to pass on or to go on or to join would be better. Will you try to find some better expression for death? When you find it, you will have quite a new interpretation of your life. It will be like an experience when I saw the water in the big waterfall. Imagine. It was 1,340 feet. We say everything comes out of emptiness. One whole river or one whole mind is emptiness. When we reach this understanding, we find the true meaning of our life. When we reach this understanding, we can see the beauty of human life. Before we realize this, everything that we see is just delusion. Sometimes we overestimate the beauty. Sometimes we underestimate or ignore the beauty, because our small mind is not in accord with reality. To talk about it this way is quite easy, but to have the actual feeling is not so easy. But by your practice of Zazen, you can cultivate this feeling. When you can sit with your whole body and mind and with the oneness of your mind, and body under the control of the universal mind, you can easily attain this kind of right understanding. Your everyday life will be renewed without being attached to an old erroneous interpretation of life. When you realize this fact, you will discover how meaningless your old interpretation was and how much useless effort you had been making. You will find the true meaning of life. And even though you have difficulty falling upright from the top of the waterfall to the bottom of the mountain, you will enjoy your life. And so me and my wife at the anniversary of her birth and passing, I often read that each year. And I think at that moment of reading, and every time I read that story, it told me, it's like, oh, just like I said earlier, it's like, I need to practice, or I first joined the Sangha because I need to figure out, one, what that story completely means. I know what it means for me, but there's something deeper there. And I realized I was using meditation as a practical purpose, for a purpose to help with wellness, with mental clarity. But there was a spiritual aspect to it. And so knowing that, and knowing that during that time, I took refuge in the Dharma. I chose to practice. Thank you.
How the silence speaks, Richard. Thank you so much.
That wonderful story, Richard.
Wow.
Josh and Laura have their hand up.
Hi. I just wanted to say, Richard, thank you so much for sharing that with us. It was beautiful. There was quite a lot in your story that I related to. So I wanted to thank you deeply for being so vulnerable, because I got so much from what you shared with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Lema?
Richard. I want to thank you so very much for your path of discovery. And when you were chatting about Catholicism and the Baptist Church, I kind of wondered, you know, of course, being Black and bodied, you know, most of us have gone into the Baptist Church, but I wonder how you have used those practices with sitting on the cushion. Mm-hmm. Zazen is a practice of, to me, it's a body practice. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder about that. And then also, did you ever do a Easter speech when you were in this church? Thank you. That was lovely. Thank you.
Thank
for
you. No, I never have done an Easter speech. I used to read the first and second reading in Roman Catholicism. So I used to be altar boy, and I did read, I don't know what they called them, lecturer at that time, but yes, never talk. And and I think my Baptist and Catholic roots, you know, I think I have used it because I've read a number of books on comparative religion, and for me, I think Jesus was, if not was, a bodhisattva. And the original, not original, but if you like, when I just read what was written about Jesus, you know, to me, that's kind of what I related to and sort of used as sort of like, I don't know, litmus test for Christianity and Catholicism whenever I felt like it was shifting from, you know, comically, what would Jesus do? Then I would say, oh, you know, I'm not comfortable with that. I don't pray much. At this point, I'm not a practicing Catholic, or I haven't been for years. And, you know, I think when I do Zazen in the morning, you know, there's a part of me that does what my grandfather used to do, because I used to pray at nighttime. And so my grandfather at one point, because he was living with us, my mom's father, I asked him one time, why are you praying in the morning? You normally pray at nighttime when you go to bed, you know, to thank God for what happened, you know. And so he would tell me, he's, oh, no, I pray in the morning because I'm so happy I woke up this morning that I get to enjoy another day. And so when I share my gratitude and when I wake up, or even when I was in a bad spot mentally, I would try to remember that. Oh, I'm so happy I woke up today.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, Will?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Richard. That was a beautiful story, a beautiful life, and in addition to being a programmer, philosopher, and now dietitian, I think you're just a fantastic therapist at that. It's just phenomenal. What I was wondering was the name that you gave your daughter, and thank you for sharing that story. What does that translate to? What is the meaning of her name?
Oh, that's a good question. I believe it translates to something like beautiful but fragile. If I remember exactly, I haven't looked up the name, but I believe when we gave her that name, that's what she meant to us. And I guess it was very painful to name her too, but yeah, I believe that's loose translation.
Thank you.
Biba, to unmute yourself.
Thank you, Richard, for sharing. You handled that situation with so much grace. You honored her life, and it's beautiful to hear. I know you said you practice Taoism, and that's honestly like where my foundations started as well, back in 2011. And I've been reading this same book over and over and over again. And I can understand what you mean about trying to figure out what it means. Because when you first start reading it, it's like things don't hit you until years later. So I would encourage you to just keep reading it, like how you've been doing. I also have this book too, The Alchemist's Tao Te Ching. And on the back of it, it says, after enlightenment. So these are instructions for once you've comprehended all the topics. When all work is done and all lessons embodied, throw the book away. So until that point comes, keep reading the word and keep studying it until you come to that point where you know what it means. and just be patient, I think. I think that's what makes it so great and so mysterious, is that it's such simple text, but it takes years and sometimes even decades to comprehend. So, thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
Jim?
Richard, that was such a powerful talk. Thank you so much. I feel like I seemed like you said at the beginning, you're just a beginner or just didn't know whether you had enough experience or something to give away Seeking Mind Talk, but I think you showed us that the experience you've had is that you've paid attention to your life. You know, you've really paid attention to your life, and that, you know, doing that and sharing it so honestly and truly was a really all you needed to do, and it was a great gift. So thank you so much.
Larry.
Hey, Richard, I just wanted to say a couple of words so that I could be able to acknowledge, you. I think there's a Facebook group I saw somewhere. They call it Real Humans of New York. And so I think you're like a real human of Sacramento. And we're so lucky to have you in our sangha. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
I'm calling on myself. Richard, I just so moved especially because your story turned around the people in your life, your parents, your grandparents, friends, teachers, like somehow you listened profoundly and then kept asking questions and then to feel your path leading you to having to face your daughter's birth and death in one moment, you know, that love that came through, you know, transcended everything. And I'll never forget that you shared that story with us. Thank you, Richard. Meg.
Yeah, Richard, I just wanted to thank you for sharing so vulnerably, so deeply about who you are and your life experience. It was deeply touching, deeply moving. And your vulnerability just shows the level, you know, you talked about taking refuge in the Dharma. But I feel like tonight you put your, sought refuge in the Sangha. Very powerful, and I thank you very much.
Well, maybe we're coming to a close for our evening. Richard, do you want to chant out?
Sure.